You're listening to the Midori House, first broadcast on the 29th of August 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller on today's show. Japanese authorities order citizens into their basements as a North Korean missile flies over the country. My guests Kathleen Burke and Robin Lustig will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including President Donald Trump's arrival in Texas as the rain following Hurricane Harvey continues to fall, Kenya's ruthlessly enforced plastic bag ban, and how far should films be allowed to cast against type? That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. So, welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Kathleen Burke, Professor of Modern and Contemporary History at University College London, and Robin Lustig, journalist and broadcaster, former presenter of BBC Radio 4's The World Tonight. Welcome both. We will start tonight in Texas, where the incredible deluge precipitated by Hurricane Harvey continues. Some parts of the state have recorded 48 inches of rain since Friday. At least 9 people are now known to have died, and tens of thousands have been forced to flee their homes. The flooding is expected to get worse in coming days, with concerns raised today about 2 major dams spilling over and some levees breaching. US President Donald Trump is visiting the state today. Robin, first of all, there being not much really we can say about the weather, I guess, other than that it's clearly terrible and we can only wish any listeners in Texas all the very best with finding some refuge and tidying up afterwards. Is it strange that the president is arriving in Texas, well, not merely so soon after it's happening, but while it's actually happening?
It's difficult, isn't it? It seems to be expected of political leaders that they do visit the victims of disasters, whether natural or otherwise, as soon as possible afterwards. Clearly, they get in the way. There is that to be considered.
Well, some more than others. I mean, I think a leader of most countries can. I think of my own experience in Australia, where Australian prime ministers will often turn up at a scene of a bushfire or a flood or something. But the Australian prime minister travels at a fairly low key level.
I imagine, compared to an American president, that has got to be true. It seems to be that in this day of instant news and media saturation, people expect to see pictures of their leaders on the spot, consoling victims, appearing to care, and I say appearing in quotes because sometimes they're better at that than others. But it's something which I think he has to do. One thinks back to President George Bush and Hurricane Katrina. He came in for a lot of stick for not being seen to be on top of that as quickly as people felt he should have been.
But he was on top, of course. He was in an aeroplane, and the idea was that he would be able to take in the whole range of the devastation. I think they're damned if they do and damned if they don't.
Which literally exactly the next question on my list here. Because George W. Bush's, I think, later explanation was that he was trying to keep out of the way, realizing that if the US president arrives anywhere, it's a massive circus. Mm. But again, that photo did just look dreadful, didn't it?
Well, it did. And one thing, someone has actually directed Trump in a better direction. He's going to Corpus Christi, which hasn't been hit nearly as much, but there's going to be scenes of devastation around him, and he can, with any luck, he'll get his trousers, ankles wet, with the water sharing the pain of the American people and so forth. What we were all wondering about is Melania's 4-inch heels when she got on the airplane. It shows perhaps she's not going to be sluttering around, as it were.
Here's the other thing that I want to know. I mean, what political leaders are expected to show on these occasions is compassion, empathy, sympathy with the victims. Now, these aren't words that one automatically associates with Donald Trump.
They're not his strong suits.
They're not, so far, his strong suits. If he can show any of that, if he can show any compassion for the victims, any sympathy for what they're going through, then it will have been a plus for him. My suspicion is that he will start saying how great all the rescue services are doing, how well the federal and state authorities are dealing with this disaster, and he will pat them and himself on the back and depart. If he does anything else, if he hugs a victim, I would be delighted.
Or a small tear in his eye.
Oh, even better.
You would not bet heavily, unfortunately, against him making some crashing reference to how much he won Texas by in 2016, would you?
Oh, don't.
But Kathleen, is this... I have read, even leaving aside the question of whether President Donald Trump is capable of putting on this sort of performance, I'm slightly... for myself, I have reservations about how necessary it is. I mean, if, and I have not been in the position where my house mercifully is filled up with 8 feet of water or burned down or anything like that, but I'm not sure that I would feel much better if some politician I'd never met turned up, threw an arm around me and felt my pain. Presumably what you want at that point is a fantastically swift and efficient government providing all the help it possibly can. Is it necessary for someone to turn up and go, diddums there, there?
No, and it didn't used to be the case. One can't really imagine Franklin Roosevelt showing up. Reagan said how appalling something was, which I can't quite remember what it was, but he did it very well, but he didn't do it in situ. I think either you or Robin, I can't recall which one of you said it, about the 24-hour news media requires this sort of thing.
I think that's the point. I mean, it's not being done, actually, for the benefit of the victim.
Of course
it's
not.
It's being done to persuade everybody else that this leader cares and is on top of the story. It is done for the visuals. That's why it's necessary.
Because no one's going to go and talk to 304,000 people and say, Did he feel your pain?
No.
Did you feel him feel your pain? That's not, I mean, it's quite right. And it's not surprising, is it? Because he's in such a divisive position right now. His minders in the White House have organized this rather well. It's evaded some of the real problems that George Bush had. And ideally, since it's out of the way of the real huge rush, no one's got him by the break in the levee of the Columbia Lakes, for example, he won't take up so much official time and effort that ought to be spent someplace else. So if he's really lucky, it's a win-win for him.
And he's not tweeting about North Korea. As far as I know, there hasn't been a single tweet so far today from President Trump.
Well, first things first, Robin.
The day is young in the United States,
true.
Robin. And we will get to that shortly. Just a final thought on this one, though, Robin. Is there any argument that there's something to be said for the leader, which is the person making, well, in theory, at the top of the decision hierarchy, actually seeing it up close? Because again, thinking back to Australia, I can recall a couple of prime ministers turning up at the site of various disasters. And in Australia, it's fires or it's floods or it's storms. But both John Howard and Kevin Rudd did come across, they're the ones I recall especially, as looking quite authentically moved by what they were seeing, that they clearly were able to relate to the people who were going through it. But aside from that, is there something to be said for the person making the decisions to actually see up close what the emergency services are up against?
It just depends, I think, on how good they are at spotting what is needed. If they actually talk to some victims and say to them, what do you need? What aren't you getting? Listen to the answer, then turn to their aides and say, see to it, make it happen, then that can have an effect. It's difficult because, of course, the people any leader meets are carefully chosen. The places they go are carefully chosen. It's not a genuine meeting experience. It may, on a good day, be better than nothing.
Well, let's hope him telling people what to do works better than it has thus far in the White House.
Yeah.
It's a bit difficult to truck in some supplies immediately, especially when the roads are all flooded.
Indeed so.
Okay, well, let's look now at the subject likeliest to have preoccupied Trump's ride on Air Force One to Texas, North Korea, which late last night, UK time, very early in the morning, Japan time, launched a missile through Japanese airspace. A statement from the White House declared that Pyongyang's message had been heard loud and clear and that all options for response were on the table. South Korea has already expressed itself via a live fire drill from four of its F-15s, dropping 8 MK-84 bombs, which are pretty much exactly the kind of thing you drop on the headquarters of a neighbouring tyrant you are beginning to find tedious. Kathleen, first of all, from North Korea's point of view, and this is the always fun part where I ask a guest to imagine what's going on in the head of Kim Jong-un, what is the strategic logic from their point of view of doing this? Because the North Koreans, as we have discussed many times, may be crazy, but they're not stupid. They know how badly this is going to go over everywhere else in the world.
Well, what do they have to lose? They know the Americans aren't going to come and take them out, don't they? Because if they see a missile coming, they will shoot off their guns by at the demilitarized line and take out Seoul and 25,000 American soldiers who are stationed near there. So the thing is, Americans don't like losing their soldiers, and losing that many would stop. And he is mostly concerned, as far as I know, reading from the people who know North Korean languages better than I do, is he doesn't want to be kicked out of power. And not being kicked out of power means making people afraid to try to kick him out of power. And also, he wants respect from the United States. He wants to be treated as an equal. And he can't be treated as an equal until he can take out San Francisco, not to mention Chicago and Atlanta, if he's really lucky. So it's perfectly rational to me. I think the problem is people think he's not being rational. But of course he's being rational.
There is the, well, if not irrational, then unpredictable aspect of this, though, Robin. As we have learned from serial failed launches, North Korean missile technology is not necessarily all that reliable. How cavalier are they being with the danger that if you do go wanging missiles into foreign airspace, it might come down early, potentially landing on a Japanese city, or perhaps, well, it's idle to say which would be worse than the other, but, you know, it's not impossible that you could end up collecting an American warship.
It's not risk-free, obviously, but the technology is plainly improving, because although they had some failed missile launches earlier this year, the last three or four, at least, have worked, have done what they were designed to do, and they've achieved exactly, as Kathleen says, what they were designed to achieve. They have made the world sit up and take notice. They have made the world take North Korea seriously. And they've said something very important to the people of North Korea and the generals of North Korea as well. Kim Jong-un hasn't blinked first. He hasn't been scared by Trump's rhetoric. He's not backing down. He's not, as I think Donald Trump said the other day, seeing sense. He is continuing to do what he believes is in his interests, in his clan's interests, and, as he sees no difference between that and the nation's interests, in North Korea's interests. I agree with Kathleen. He's being perfectly rational.
And along the way, of course, having taken out a number of generals, not and his uncle, of course, he has suppressed any chance of a successful coup against him. And now that he has the international approach, that it's in no one's interest amongst his own Politburo and so forth to try to take him out.
There's one other thing I think which we need to bear in mind. These missile launches coincide with the joint military exercises that the US routinely carries out with both Japan and South Korea. From Pyongyang, they look like threats, and therefore they have to be met with a threat in the other direction. The timing is not a coincidence. I think the record shows that there tend to be this ratcheting up of tension every time there are these joint exercises.
Of course, these joint exercises take place every year. Mm-hmm.
I wonder myself whether you can realistically interpret something as a threat or a provocation when it's sort of advertised that far in advance and occurs at roughly the same time every year.
But it can be used with his own people.
Yeah, I guess so. Kathleen, what did you make of that slightly curiously worded response from the White House, though, which said that it had heard North Korea's message loud and clear? What message do we think the White House has heard, and is it the same one that North Korea intended to communicate?
Well, that they are going to continue to threaten the U.S. as well as long as the U.S. continues to threaten them. I can only assume, and also that Kim Jong-un expects to be treated as a major world leader. As I said before, as far as I'm concerned, that's probably what he wants. If the point is, the White House has always treated him as someone who can be pressured, can be forced to back down, and to say that we're not going to talk to him until he gives up his nuclear ambitions, that's just stupid. That's just stupid. It's hard to believe that grown people actually think that's a viable argument.
I think I made this point last time we spoke, Andrew, but if you're Kim Jong-un and you look at what happened to other leaders who gave up their nuclear arsenals, whether it was
Libya,
Muammar Gaddafi in Libya, whether it was Saddam Hussein in Iraq, where are they now? Hmm. If you were Kim, would you want to go that way? Of course not.
Well, in that being the question, or that being the case rather, the question is, which I'm sure is the one presently preoccupying the leaderships of the United States, China, Japan and South Korea, what is the reasonable response? It doesn't strike me that you can just sort of wave this off, ignore it, say, please don't do that again. They are obliged to respond somehow, but what is a reasonable response to this?
I think the sanctions route makes sense. I mean, it's not terribly effective, but it is something that can be done. There were, some years ago, the so-called six power talks, in which all of the local governments, including the North and South Koreans, the Russians, the Chinese, the Japanese, sat down and tried to do some kind of a deal. It worked for a period of time. Eventually, the North Koreans backed out for reasons of their own. To me, that is the only way forward. But each side somehow has to find a way to back away from this horribly dangerous game of chicken. Who is going to blink first? It could lead, by mistake, to a real, real disaster.
What's the one of the interesting things in that, just briefly, is you notice Russia, for the first time, has put in a word. If you look at a map, Russia's awful close. You know, if they want to go in certain ways, like over the pole, they have to go over Russia.
Kathleen, Japan's Prime Minister Shinzo Abe gave a clearly not impressed, but nonetheless fairly measured response. He is a generally fairly measured fellow. He said Japan will call for increased pressure, but like what?
Yes, there's not a lot left. That I think they're hoping China. I mean, China's the only one. China has now started really ratcheting up in a way that refused to do for decades, you know, for months, if not years. Who else gives or sells things to North Korea? Who else lets North Korea, Korean boats dock in their harbors? I think one has to look out a bit further and just see, and then see where North Korea fits any place and track it back.
Okay, well, we're going to take a short break now. You are listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, along with Kathleen Burke and Robin Lustig. Coming up next, how long should you go to jail for using a plastic bag?
Are you looking to strike a better work-life balance? If so, then the shiny new September issue of Monocle magazine is just what the doctor ordered. Join Monocle's business team as they head for the most agreeable third-tier cities. Moving advice for those on the hunt for a new live-work base. Breathe in, breathe out, and discover why third tier definitely doesn't mean third class. Step into the office of some select founders and CEOs to see exactly how they go about their work. From illustrator Christoph Niemann to legendary designer Dries Van Noten. And there's more. Hear from the first female Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, illuminating views on Geneva's neon scene, a walk through the transformative architecture of Jakarta, and savour the sight of Sweden's garden restaurants brought to delicious life on the page. That's all in the September issue of Monocle, on newsstands everywhere now, or head to monocle.com to become a subscriber.
Who are the young designers you should be looking out for? Who's leading the way when it comes to architecture, fashion, product and interior design? And what lessons from design history should we all be taking note of?
He really was an artist whose medium of expression was fashion.
I could never live in a place that I designed because I'm not designing for myself.
You look for where there is a potential for creativity, for poetry. So architectural lighting, where the dialogue with architecture can become something very interesting.
Monocle 24's design programme Section D delves deep into the places, communities and manufacturers that make the design industry what it is. From trade shows to trend forecasts, tune in every Tuesday and make Section D the object of your attention.
You're You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Molister. With me are Kathleen Burke and Robin Lustig. A ban on plastic bags is not in itself an innovation. Dozens of countries or smaller jurisdictions within countries have banned plastic bags or implemented penalties upon their use. That ante has been sensationally upped by Kenya, which has not merely banned plastic bags, but has done so on threat of a fine equivalent to $40,000 or up to 4 years in the clink for anyone caught manufacturing, selling, or even possessing one of the receptacles. Robin, we will come to the punishment briefly, but first of all, the principle. Is there any argument against banning plastic bags, really?
Let's start from basic principles. Plastic bags are a bad thing. They do horrible things to the planet, to the environment, to the oceans and seas, and to marine life. It would be good if nobody used them anymore. Banning things is difficult. I quite like the approach that's been adopted here in the UK and in other countries, which is that you make people pay for plastic bags, and therefore you disincentivize their use, and you make it more of an advantage for people not to use them than to use them. It's called nudging.
This has been in the UK, I looked it up earlier, astoundingly effective.
Yeah.
A 5p charge on plastic bags in the UK, which is beans. And at the time, I didn't think, well, you know, who's going to make this decision over 5p? But it has reduced plastic bag use in the UK by 85%, which amounts to 6 billion fewer bags every year.
Yeah, it's pretty remarkable,
it's
isn't
astounding.
It? Yeah, and it, you haven't actually banned them. I mean, I'm a libertarian. I don't believe in banning things unless there's a very good reason. As I say, I don't like plastic bags. I think there should be fewer of them, preferably none of them at all. But the kind of strikingly stringent penalties that the Kenyans are proposing, I think is probably not a good idea.
Okay, you two. First, we lost out on paper bags because that killed trees. Now we're going to lose out on plastic bag because that kills cows. So what are you going to carry your groceries home in?
Hessian is the stuff. Or hemp.
And how much if you're a market trader in Kenya, are you going to pay for a Hessian bag?
Well, there's another argument occurring in Kenya, Kathleen, about the short-term, well, hopefully only short-term economic impact, because Kenya, it turns out, is a major exporter of plastic bags. The industry in Kenya employs some 60,000 people. Mm. Now, 60,000 lost jobs in Kenya is no small change.
Well, I noticed that their environmental minister said, well, this gives you the chance to come up with something better.
Well, that's
good luck with that.
It's an argument easy for him to say.
Well, indeed.
I suspect.
Well,
might be
that's
the retort.
Why it's easy for people to say give them up and not thinking just how. I mean, if you go to your local Waitrose or Lidl or whatever, wherever you go, how are you going to carry your bags home? Well, you buy a life bag, of course, and use it over and over and over and over and over again. I would have to pay. I mean, you pay 10 pence for that, and that's reasonable.
Yeah, I mean, it is a real issue. I mean, I've traveled quite a lot in Africa, and I've been to quite a lot of African food markets, and all of the traders there put their produce in plastic bags. That's what they do. The problem is those plastic bags then get discarded. You're going to have to find some way of replacing those plastic bags with something else, whether it is paper, which means cutting down trees, or whether it is some other kind of cloth or hemp bag, I don't know. But you've got to provide an alternative. People need bags to put their shopping in.
Well, then isn't the answer then that just people are going to have to bring their own?
Easier said than done. Yes, of course, and in this country that is what has happened. But I think it's not that easy to do. People survived, of course, before plastic bags were invented. They will survive again if alternatives are provided. You cannot expect overnight to say to people, hey presto, no more plastic bags or you go to jail. It's just not a sensible
way
of doing it.
On that subject, Kathleen, as we were discussing, a 5p charge in this country has had a fairly extraordinary effect. A 22-cent charge in Ireland has had a broadly similar effect. Now, I can't claim myself a 100% record on always remembering to take my actual Monocle-branded tote bag to Tesco with me, but So occasionally I end up wearing the 5p charge. I have to say, if I was looking at $40,000 or 4 years in jail, then I'd make damn sure I took a cloth bag. And I suspect that will be the case in Kenya. But the thing is, somebody is going to transgress. And is the problem then, because there will be huge international attention on this, that Kenya will end up looking a bit insane when it imprisons someone for 4 years for ownership of a plastic bag?
Yes, I don't understand where they came with the 4 years. You could have a misdemeanor to start with.
I would have thought 2 weeks. You know, at an absolute outside, people would get the message.
Right, and you're a market trader woman.
Even that's not going to work. I mean, can you think how many million extra prison cells they're going to have to do. There's another issue as well. In countries where people live very close to the poverty line, in countries where the security forces are appallingly badly paid, there is corruption. Every time somebody is stopped walking along the road back to their home with a plastic bag in their hand and a police vehicle draws up and says, hey, you're breaking the law, the temptation will be for a small amount of money to change hands and the police vehicle will go on its way. It is just an invitation to more low-level corruption, more low-level hardship, and it probably, in the short term at least, won't have a huge effect.
OK, well, finally tonight, a meditation, if you will, on the limits of acting. Specifically, is it or is it not OK for someone who dresses up as other people for a living to dress up as someone of a different ethnic background? The actor Ed Skrein has withdrawn from the imminent reboot of Hellboy, which I'm sure our listeners were as excited about as I was, in the face of criticism for agreeing to play a Japanese-American, neither of which description fits Mr. Skrein of Camden Town, not far from here. Robin, his quote withdrawing from the production of this doubtless splendid motion picture talked of representing a character in a culturally accurate way. The character he was going to play, Major Ben Damio, is in fact a comic book character. Is this... I can't fault the intentions behind this. I do, I think, understand what he's saying, and we should now recognise up front we're now going to have three white people talking about this. But is this being a bit precious in the case of a comic book character?
In an ideal world, actors would be given parts for which producers think they are best suited. After all, you yourself made the point. Actors are paid to pretend to be somebody else. You don't expect every actor in a Shakespeare play set in Italy to be Italian. Nevertheless, I do think there is an important point. There are huge numbers of actors who come from minority backgrounds who find it very difficult to get work because there aren't enough parts which producers are prepared to give them.
Indeed,
so. If an actor from a white community is prepared to stand aside and say, this is a part which I think ought properly to be given to, in this case, a Japanese-American actor or somebody else from a minority, then I think it is laudable. I wish it weren't so, but if people are being discriminated against, then I think people from the majority community are well advised to try to do whatever they can in whatever small way to help confront that discrimination.
I mean, I do recognise that it's not the same thing because in the instance I'm about to cite, it's one white person playing another white person. But I can remember all those years ago in Australia a certain amount of umbrage when Meryl Streep and her dreadful Australian accent were cast in the role of Lindy Chamberlain in the film about the infamous dingo baby case. It was pointed out at the time that we do have actors in Australia, some of them very good and at least able to do the accent.
I'm pulled two ways here a bit. On the one hand, that means no more Fiona Shaw as Hamlet, because it's not Princess Hamletta, is it? So there goes all the gender blind stuff we've been hearing about the past 5 years. On the other hand, the next time an Indian American is going to be played by a white person, the media is going to show that in such a an aura that it won't happen. So what he has done, in fact, has turned this. I think it'll be very difficult to have an Asian American done by a Camden white again.
I went to see a production a few months ago of the play Amadeus by Peter Schaffer about Mozart and Salieri. The part of Salieri was taken by a black actor. Salieri was not black. Nevertheless, it didn't matter in the slightest that the actor was. He was a superb actor, and it was a fantastic performance. I do think, ideally, acting should be gender-blind, race-blind, but we don't live in an ideal world. And as I said a moment ago, if actors from minority communities are being discriminated against, and they are, then I'm in favour of something being done about it.
Is the answer below, Kathleen, really in the long run not to make sure that there's just more and better roles for minority actors in films?
No, and yes, of course, just as there should be more roles for older women. This is a common thing, which is silly because more women go to films than men do, but never mind about that. But we're not in an ideal world, and also what's going to determine it is the box office. If it's discovered, if it's ascertained, if it's suspected that doing in a certain manner plunges your takings, It's not going to happen.
Well, that does bring us to the end of today's show. Kathleen Burke and Robin Lustig, thanks very much for joining us at Midori House. The show was produced by Henry Reece Sheridan, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Sophia Amadi. Our studio manager was David Stevens. More music next at 1900, Section D with Josh Fennett. There's more on the day's main stories on the Daily at 2200. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London time. I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening.